Hostages' bodies are returned. This is Israeli government spokesperson Shash Bedrosian.
What I can share with you is the team is using between 2 to 3 excavator machines and 2 to 3 trucks to search for our deceased hostages. Now, the Red Cross and the Egyptian team are allowed entry beyond the IDF's yellow line position into Gaza territory to conduct the search for our hostages.
Gaza authorities say an estimated 10,000 Palestinians may be trapped under the rubble and have called for access to the same equipment used to search for the dead Israeli hostages. Meanwhile, UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, warns people in Gaza are increasingly in need of warmth as cold weather approaches, writing in a social media post, quote, shelter materials and winter supplies for displaced families are sitting in UNRWA warehouses in Jordan and Egypt, blocked from entry. For more on the ceasefire, violations of the deal, and if it'll last, and what the next steps are, we're joined by Jeremy Scahill, co-founder of Dropsite News, where he's been closely covering the Gaza ceasefire. He's the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, and Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Jeremy. If you could start off, you're in a really unique position. You're one of the only Western journalists to regularly interview Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. You broke the story that they had accepted the ceasefire deal more than half an hour before President Trump announced it. Talk about where you see it standing today.
I mean, first of all, on the issue of speaking to Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad, this should be basic journalistic practice. In fact, it's utter malpractice on the part of all of these news organizations that have not regularly been interviewing the leaders, the negotiators of Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. This is by default allowing the dehumanization narrative of Palestinians to just take hold. When the United States and Israel make allegations against Hamas, against Islamic Jihad, against the Palestinian armed resistance, the job of journalists should not be to just say, oh, well, they're verboten. We can't speak to them. Our job should be to say, let's fact check these governments. Let's talk to these people. And when the U.S. started directly speaking to Hamas in the form of Adam Bowler, who is a college friend of Jared Kushner, his former roommate, he was the special envoy on hostages. He goes and he speaks with Hamas leaders. And I spoke to those very leaders that Adam Bowler spoke to. Bowler comes out and does interviews not just on CNN, but on Israeli television saying, these guys are not what has been presented. This becomes dangerous because when you humanize people on the other side, you start to fact check a 77-year narrative of Israel that's been bolstered by the U.S. That's how actually you get a human understanding. The Palestinians have a great range of views on Hamas, and that's for Palestinians to decide. But what has been enabled by large, powerful media corporations is a total silencing of the voices of Palestinians, which is why then you end up with this cartoonish portrayal. Oh, they're just terrorists. These guys are doctors, they're lawyers, they're veterinarians,
well,
they're chemists.
Tell us who they are. Tell us, name them and tell us who they are.
Well, first of all, I mean, Khalil al-Haya, who is the political leader in Gaza of Hamas, was a top aide to Yahya Sinwar, the former leader of Hamas who was assassinated by the Israelis. And Yahya Sinwar himself, all of these guys, their biographies, they grew up in a concentration camp. They grew up in an open-air prison in Gaza. You could tell a biography of every one of the leaders of Hamas, including the guys who Israel says, oh, they live in 5-star hotels abroad. All of them have had direct family members killed. Khalil al-Haya, multiple sons of his were killed, including one of his sons killed in the September 9th attempt to assassinate the negotiators in Qatar. Bassem Naim, another one, a doctor educated in Germany, but from Gaza. He has had multiple family members killed, including recently his son. These are all, if you can contrast the leadership of Hamas
in the bombing Qatar.
In the bombing of Qatar, you know, they failed to kill any of the senior Hamas officials, but they did kill multiple administrative staff, including Khalil al-Haya's secretary. They not only bombed, they hit with 12 missiles. They not only bombed the offices that Hamas had in Qatar at the request of the United States. Hamas was in Qatar to do these kinds of negotiations, but they hit the residence of Khalil al-Haya. They wounded his wife, his daughter-in-law, they killed his son, and they wounded multiple grandchildren, some of them very seriously. You contrast that with Netanyahu's son, who's running around Miami living his life like a spoiled frat boy. Khalil al-Haya has had multiple sons killed. So you can have a debate, and Palestinians do, about what Hamas is. But it is total journalistic malpractice that more news organizations are not saying, we need to aggressively report. What is their perspective? What do they say to these allegations?
So talk about their perspective on the ceasefire and how you reported the ceasefire deal before Trump announced it. What they agreed to early on and what ended up being agreed to. And then we're going to talk about the bodies of hostages on both sides.
Let's remember that when Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were in office, they brokered one short truce a month into the war in November, where there were as an exchange of captives. There was an opportunity to end the war right there. And Biden, the main difference between Biden and Trump is a transactional guy. You should think of him as having these spheres of influence that are constantly circling his face. And whichever one he sort of captures at a moment, he then focuses on it. I don't think Trump could actually define what Zionism is. You know, he talks about Adelson, oh, she's got $60 billion in the bank. He has people that are hardcore Zionists in his administration. But then he also is very close to all of these Arab Gulf monarchies. And he's doing business with them in the private sector and now in the White House. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, bankrolled to the tune of billions of dollars from Qatar, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates. So he's a transactional, erratic character that ultimately is looking to make constant real estate deals and cut off the top for profits for himself. Biden committed Zionist ideologue his entire political career. So Matt Miller, the former State Department spokesperson under Joe Biden, admitted recently in an interview with Israeli television that the Biden administration allowed Netanyahu to repeatedly sabotage ceasefires and that they didn't go after him in a real way for fear that it would jeopardize a ceasefire. I mean, you just think of the logic of it. But this was admitted by the State Department spokesperson that was the default policy of Biden. So when Trump becomes the president-elect, he then says, I want a ceasefire by the time that I come into office. And part of this was just his ego. He said, I'm going to end the war in Ukraine, you know, within an hour of taking office or a day of taking office. You know, a lot of this was bluster. He would say whatever he needed to say to win. He also was able to exploit the fact that Kamala Harris's position, when asked about all of this, was, I wouldn't change a thing. You know, the position on the Gaza war was a huge factor in why Donald Trump took power. And, you know, Democrats need to face that. And Kamala Harris is on this revisionist book tour right now. She doesn't like it when people bring this up. But that's a fact. She had an opportunity to distinguish herself from Biden, and she doubled down on, I wouldn't change a thing. So whatever we think of Donald Trump and his motives, there wouldn't have been that original January ceasefire deal. 42 days into it, Trump allows the Israelis to blow it up. They immediately, on March 2nd, reimpose a massive full-spectrum blockade on Gaza. We shouldn't call it humanitarian aid. Israel's an occupying power. These are life essentials. Humanitarian aid makes it sound like we need to just supplement the nutrition. They locked Gaza down completely. No food, no medicine, no life essentials, and starvation starts to take hold. March 18th, Israel resumes scorched earth terror bombing with the full enthusiastic support of the White House, and it goes on like that. To fast forward a bit through this, there were rumblings about trying to restart a ceasefire process, the U.S. and Israel demanding that Hamas and Islamic Jihad accept what they called the Witkoff framework, 13-point plan that would have started with an initial 60-day ceasefire in exchange of roughly half the captives that the Palestinians hoped would lead to a permanent end to the war, but there were not great guarantees in it. By August 18th, Hamas officially accepts what the Qatari mediator said was 98% of the terms that the U.S. and Israel had demanded. Instead of responding to that, Israel begins to publicly threaten the external political leadership of Hamas, culminating with Trump saying, if you don't accept this deal, nasty things are going to happen to you. Not talking about the Palestinians in general, talking about the Hamas leadership. It's very important. Trump, at a time when Israel starts to say, we're going to assassinate the external leadership, the negotiators of Hamas that are in Qatar because the U.S. asked Qatar to house them, it's pretty clear that Trump, one of two things, either greenlit an operation to kill those leaders or allowed it to happen. This cover story, oh, Steve Witkoff just didn't make it in time to WhatsApp to tell the emir of Qatar, that was the dominant story, is nonsense. And Witkoff then goes on 60 Minutes and tells a different story, that they didn't know anything about it. So already there's a disconnect in their cover story, which is classic for the Trump administration. So instead of then saying to the Palestinian side, after they accept this deal, let's talk about some of the technical aspects of this, Israel then conducts an attempt to assassinate the political leadership of Hamas, the chief negotiators of Hamas. Remember, the last under Biden, the last real serious ceasefire discussion was the summer of 2024. The Hamas on July 2nd, 2024, accepted a deal that the U.S. said they would get Israel to accept. Israel's response was to assassinate Ismail Haniyeh, the head of Hamas, in Tehran, Iran, where he was attending the inauguration of the new Iranian president. They bombed Ismail Haniyeh in a guest house owned by the most elite unit of the Iranian military. For 77 years, the Israelis are constantly assassinating any Palestinian that is willing to make a deal. And people around the world should be asking why. So then nothing happens. And they were sitting in Qatar looking at a 100-word ceasefire proposal that they were told came from Donald Trump. They gathered to do this, and that's when the assassination strike
the latest assassination
place.
Strike.
And they failed to kill any of the political leaders. And I knew, personally, I knew two of the senior Hamas leaders that were targets in this and have interviewed them numerous times, Bassem Naim and Ghazi Hamad. I also knew two of the young people that were killed in this strike. They were office assistants. These were guys that when you meet with Hamas in their offices are bringing in coffee or they're carrying bags. These are the logistical people. They're young people. That's who they killed. They didn't kill any of the senior leaders.
And how did they kill them? What was the intelligence?
I mean, there's a lot of stories about this right now. And, you know, the Palestinian story on this is that they were aware that they were targets. You know, the Israeli chief of staff had said days before this that that our arm can outstretch even to the external leadership. You know, many Palestinian resistance figures don't go anywhere near a telephone. Those that do carry them when they go into a meeting, and this is just common sense, obviously aren't bringing the phone into the meeting. Now, 10 years ago, we would have said that the Israelis were using geolocation data from the phones. We saw this under Obama's, you know, drone strike program. I think now the Israelis have, you know, far more sophisticated technology than we understand. So people tend to think, oh, it was that, you know, it has to do with the phones.
Being in another room where the assistants were.
You know, obviously the Mossad has extensive intelligence operations all around the world. I think there's some question of whether the intent was to actually kill Khalil al-Hayy and the negotiators, or the intent was to do exactly what they did, try to kill family members and others as a warning shot. I don't have any information about it. I think Israel doesn't often miss its target in this capacity.
Jeremy, talk about what's happening now. As the second phase is being discussed, how is the Palestinian leadership, and who is the Palestinian leadership that is organizing right now, both in Gaza and the West Bank?
This is another great example of media malpractice. We use the word Hamas because Hamas is leading the negotiations. They are the combatants in this war in a military sense because they're holding the Israeli captives. They're the fighting force, Hamas and Islamic Jihad. And they have a mandate, they say, from the Palestinian factions to negotiate an end to this acute part of the war, withdrawal, ceasefire, exchange of captives. But what they've said consistently is any issues about disarmament of the Palestinian people, governance of Gaza, the future attempts to, in a robust way, unify the occupied West Bank, occupied Jerusalem, and Gaza under the banner of an independent Palestinian state, those are not the mandate of Hamas. And so if news organizations were doing real reporting on this, what they would know is that for much of the genocide, Hamas has consulted with a wide range of political factions, including its political opponents, including people like Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, who doesn't control an armed force, is a physician that has run for president of Palestine. He has emerged as an incredibly important figure in this because he has systematically refused to kick armed resistance under the bus, has robustly defended the Palestinian cause, but remains engaged in the world. So right now, what you're seeing is that Hamas and Islamic Jihad made a limited deal that has to do with this genocide and ending the occupation of Gaza, while understanding that the very future of the Palestinian cause is up for grabs. And so in the past several days, there have been a flurry of meetings with a range of political factions. An extraordinary meeting took place between Khalil al-Hayy, the leader of Hamas, and Hussein Sheikh, the designated successor of Mahmoud Abbas, the decrepit, corrupt leader of the Palestinian Authority. Hussein Sheikh is very close to the United States, is very close to Israel. There's great suspicion about his role in Palestine. But Hamas is in an open, engaged conversation with Fatah. And what the Palestinians are saying from across the spectrum, and Fatah is also saying this, we need to have a unified front because this is a neocolonial agenda. This is talking about a privatization of Gaza. This is talking about huge investments coming in. This is talking about foreign troops coming in. This will cut to the heart of the very cause for liberation. So I think all Palestinian factions, regardless of what they think about Hamas or Islamic Jihad, are on, a loosely speaking, the same page. They understand the very future is up for grabs.
Jeremy, before you go, I want to ask you about the dead hostages, the bodies of the dead hostages. The Palestinians are saying they need heavy equipment. Yeah. Red Cross and Egypt, I think, is bringing in the heavy equipment to find these bodies. The question is, will that equipment be able to stay as people claw their way through the rubble to find their loved ones as they return to their rubble homes, their demolished homes?
You know, there are believed to be roughly 13 or so bodies of Israeli captives left. The great Yemeni cartoonist Kamal Sharaf had a piece of art the other day that showed a camera snaked to a piece of construction equipment, pummeling through the ground past dead Palestinian bodies to try to find one Israeli body. And, you know, everything that Israel has accused the Palestinians of, Israel does as a matter of doctrine. You know, the confession, you know, the accusation is the confession, and we've seen that for 2 years. Donald Trump said, what kind of sick people hold dead bodies? Israel, since 1967, has had a policy of holding the bodies of Palestinians. As of before the genocide, there were believed to be more than 720 Palestinian bodies being held in coolers and numbered graves by Israel. There may be as many as 1,500 Palestinian bodies held by Israel since October 7th. So estimates are more than 2,000 dead Palestinian bodies are being held by Israel right now. One Palestinian political prisoner, his body has been held since 1980. 45 years. So when Trump says, what kind of sick and twisted people hold dead bodies? Israel does it since 1967. Estimates of more than 2,000 Palestinian bodies right now. And those bodies that have come back, some of them bound, gagged, ropes around the neck. While we're sitting here, Amy, Palestinians are sitting in tents watching screens of this is the tooth of one of the bodies. This is the hand. This is the piece of clothing because there's no identification on them. Not to mention the stories of the living hostages freed from Israeli captivity, telling horrifying stories of being tortured, telling the stories of what's happening to the political leaders that are behind bars in Israeli captivity right now. Let's talk about hostages. Let's talk about dead bodies. It's state doctrine in Israel to do the things that Donald Trump and the world says are sick or sadistic or torture. Look at the Israeli captives and the condition they were in, held for 2 years under starvation and mass bombing, versus the Palestinians coming with their blinded eyes, limbs removed, in wheelchairs, telling stories of sadistic torture with dogs urinating on them, with being beaten repeatedly, intentionally infected with scabies and other diseases, looking like they just survived concentration camps.
Last question. We only have 30 seconds. What about the news of Israel involvement with certain Palestinian clans or families in Gaza?
Yeah, I mean, I would encourage people also to look at TropSite. We've done extensive reporting about this. But throughout history, you always try to find collaborators and bootlickers that you can empower to try to do your dirty work for you. And throughout the genocide, Israeli-backed gangs have been the primary looters. Israeli-backed gangs have been terrorizing the Palestinian population. And right now, you have 3 to 5 gangs in different parts of Gaza that are operating from the areas that the Israeli military is occupying. You know, roughly 50% of Gaza is under full-blown occupation right now. And I think you're going to see an attempt to foment something resembling a civil war. That has failed repeatedly, though. When Hamas did these and the security forces in Gaza did these public executions, there was a lot of focus on this, disproportionate to all the other issues. But law and order, Trump said, needs to be imposed. And I think Trump's people realize that they're going to have a tough time doing anything in Gaza without Hamas. It's been the governing authority for so long. Israel absolutely wants Palestinians to be killing each other, and that's been the point of this from the beginning of backing these gangs.
Jeremy Scahill, co-founder of DropSite News, closely covering the Gaza ceasefire. We thank you very much for being with us. Coming up, early voting's begun in New York's mayor race. A massive rally took place last night. 13,000 people in the Forest Hills Stadium. We will look at the front runners, Zoran Mamdani. If he wins, he's got a double-digit lead right now in the polls. He would be the first Muslim mayor. Stay with us.
gather your dreams all around you. Think of all the good things that you own. The moon and the stars up above you. That may come your way, memories that just you two can share. Gather your dreams all around you. Those are things beautiful. No one can take away.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show here in New York, where early voting began this weekend in the city's mayoral race with a record 164,000 ballots cast in the first 2 days. Democratic Socialist mayor candidate Zoran Mamdani spoke Sunday evening before 13,000 supporters who packed the Forest Hills Stadium.
Together, New York, we're going to freeze the... Together, New York, we're going to make buses fast and together, New York, we're going to deliver universal. We will make our city one where every person who calls it home can live a dignified life.
Mamdani spoke alongside independent Senator Bernie Sanders, New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and New York Governor Kathy Hochul, who endorsed Mamdani over former Governor Andrew Cuomo, who she replaced when Cuomo resigned in disgrace in 2021 after an inquiry found he sexually harassed at least 11 women. If elected, Zoran Mamdani would be the city's first Muslim mayor. In recent days, he's faced a string of Islamophobic attacks, including from Cuomo, who made this widely condemned remark Thursday on the Sid and Friends in the Morning radio show.
Any given morning, there's a crisis. And people's lives are at stake. God forbid another 9/11. Can you imagine Mamdani in the seat?
And there's a I could. He'd be cheering.
It's another problem. But can you imagine that?
No. No.
On Friday, Zoran Mamdani responded to the surge of Islamophobia in the mayoral campaign, speaking outside the Islamic Cultural Center in the Bronx.
To be Muslim in New York is to expect indignity. But indignity does not make us distinct. There are many New Yorkers who face it. It is the tolerance of that indignity that does.
Leading Democratic mayoral candidate Zoran Mamdani speaking Friday. For more, we're joined by Meher Ahmad, a staff editor for the New York Times Opinion section. She interviewed Mamdani for her New York Times Opinion essay headlined, "When I Look at Zoran Mamdani, Here's What I See." Welcome to Democracy Now! What do you see?
I see a dynamic that I think lots of Muslims have experienced in the United States, which is when they're given positions of power or are in a position of public scrutiny, that their faith is often the first thing that gets scrutinized. And that's part of the reason I was interested in writing this piece. I think I saw the degree of Islamophobia that Mamdani was already facing after the Democratic primary nomination in June, and was shocked not just at the cadence of attacks, but also the kind of rhetoric that was being used against him by people within his own party.
So talk about what he's faced right up through, well, President Trump and most recently, Vice President J.D. Vance.
That's right. In the last week or so, we're seeing kind of outright Islamophobic attacks against him, where politicians have said things like another 9/11 could happen if he were to become mayor. They've outright called him a jihadist or terrorist. But in the weeks prior to that, what we've seen is kind of a normalization of Islamophobic attacks against him, accusations of him being anti-Semitic, accusations of him harboring hatred towards Jews. And these kinds of accusations are ones that I think many Muslims are very familiar with. So we've kind of witnessed these attacks as a way to sideline us when we enter positions of power. And with Mamdani being one of the most high-profile politicians right now with the Muslim faith, that's kind of become the main line of attack against him.
Mamdani was talking about what happened after 9/11 with Muslims, especially in New York. And Republicans like Vice President J.D. Vance attacked his comments. Vance wrote, quote, according to Zohran, the real victim of 9/11 was his auntie who got some allegedly bad looks. Talk more about what happened. I mean, this generation that has grown up in the wake of 9/11, of Muslim New Yorkers and Americans.
Yeah, and in New York in particular, where there was a large NYPD surveillance program that was deemed unconstitutional after the fact, Muslims were surveilled in their places of prayer, in their homes, at sporting events, really, and everyday aspects of their lives. And what that ends up doing to a community is it puts them on the back foot. It makes it feel as though we need to prove ourselves as not guilty to be able to participate in the city and to participate in any aspect of life. So to become politically engaged felt that much more frightening. And I think Mamdani speaks to this. There's this feeling of the way that you act amongst yourselves in your community privately, where you feel more free to be yourself versus how you act when you go out into the street. And after 9/11, you know, there was an uptick of Islamophobic attacks against Muslims all over the country, but particularly in New York City. And people who were visibly Muslim, particularly women who wear hijabs, often became the target of those kinds of attacks. I think Mamdani's comments had to do with the fact that his aunt, you know, he said, felt too uncomfortable to go into public because she was wearing a hijab. J.D. Vance's comments then mock that and say, oh, she's, you know, supposedly the real victim of 9/11 because she felt this way. I think there's many, many victims of that event. And to discount the experience of Muslim Americans as being one that needs to be compared to, you know, other victims of that attack really makes it so that we have no right to be to even express that we've been facing racism and bigotry.
Zohran Mamdani, when he was state assembly member, got arrested outside Senator Schumer's house. Maybe that's not why he has not endorsed him around the issue of Gaza. Mamdani's been very outspoken on Palestinian rights. I interviewed him at the Jewish Voice for Peace mass protest about 1,000 mainly Jews shutting down Grand Central around Gaza. You write, the candidates become an avatar for many things, but when it comes to Islamophobia after October 7th, Mr. Mamdani's the poster child for the double standards Muslims in America are held to today. Explain.
You know, I think advocating for Palestine is a complicated and difficult thing to do in the United States for a variety of reasons. But advocating for Palestinian rights while being Muslim is a particularly unique experience. And I think part of that is because anti-Palestinian sentiment kind of rides on the back of Islamophobic ideas of who Muslims are. So when Muslims such as Mamdani advocate for Palestinian human rights, it becomes not just that they're, you know, advocating for Palestinians, but they're advocating for violence or attacks against Jews. And that's exactly what we've seen, you know, the accusations being hurtled against him. We saw a group of rabbis say that Jews would be in danger if he was to become the mayor. You know, some of the people that I spoke to for this story, I kind of asked to elaborate. When you say you live in fear of him, what do you actually mean? And the explanation that I heard was that his criticism of Israel, which has now been accepted by, you know, multiple human rights organizations, is equivalent to advocating for violence against Jews. What I argue is that kind of assumption of Muslims is inherently racist, to assume that we have hatred towards Jews and to kind of use that as a bludgeon to make it so that our views on Palestine can't be expressed publicly.
Mm-hmm. And of course, so many thousands of his organizers or canvassers on the ground are Jewish New Yorkers.
Exactly.
I want to end by thanking you. Meher Ma'amed is a staff editor for the New York Times opinion section. Her latest essay for the New York Times is headlined, "When I Look at Zohran Mamdani, Here's What I See." In the print version, the headline was, "What Does It Mean to Be a Good Muslim in America?" That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
One more thing before your interview. Can I have your address, please?
I live on Main Street.
I need your exact address.
I live on Main Street.
Oh.
No job, no home. And no home, no job. Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca. Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.